Let's get down to business on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. When it comes to working on your own, George Seberg is all business, as is Garrison Keillor with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Are angels fear to tread? Is it really that risky a business to start, be on your own?
Well, yes, Don, after going through two near bankruptcies, yes.
I could go through bankruptcy without working on my own.
Well, you know, people starting business, 80% of businesses, small businesses, fail in the first 5 years. In the first 10 years, 90% of businesses fail. So it's an adventure.
You know, that's true. I've seen those statistics, and I've wondered what combination of nerve and ambition does it take to launch out on your own?
Well, I think you have to be a little naive, too.
Well, that's always the case, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, of course, if we weren't, we wouldn't be parents either. I mean, there are a lot of important things we wouldn't be if we knew what was up.
That's true. My wife used to say, why do they give this job to people who don't know what they're doing?
So did you decide to write a book to warn potential people or to give them at least some head start as to how to do it? Or, you know, what led to the book?
Well, it's just that I kept a diary of my business as I started. I planned for it as much as a year in advance before I thought, well, if I ever do go into business, I want to at least have some things to help me. And one of them was a company in Cleveland, Ohio called Lincoln Electric Company, a very fine company. They, incidentally, as of 1995, were the highest paid industrial manufacturing workers in the world.
Really?
And they it was a very good company, disciplined, and high morale.
Uh-huh.
And I went out there, made several trips there, and I my articles of incorporation I took from their book that James Lincoln wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what business did you go into?
Machining and fabricating. I'm a registered professional engineer. I was in the consulting business before, but I've always liked manufacturing. Probably the nicest job I ever had was when I was working for a consulting engineering firm in Springfield, Illinois. I was in charge, responsible for making sure that all the work was done in a 1.3 million square foot plant of Alice Chalmers in Springfield. And it was fun. I so much enjoyed process, making things run. How do we make this cheaper? How do we make this the best way to give the highest quality? And that really excites me, doing those kinds of things.
And so you decide to add an extra element of excitement and doing it on your own.
Well, I didn't really plan on that. I came up here from Springfield as recruited by a gentleman who was a genius. He had a 170 IQ in the Mensa Society. John Taylor at Taylor & Company. And the industrial work in the Springfield area was dying off. And that's what I like to do. I'm a mechanical engineer. I could have gotten into heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, but I wasn't really interested in that. So I met John at a conference in Chicago. And I came over here and came up and went to work for him in Bettendorf. John was a genius. I've seen him do things that astounded me in what he did. But the big but is that he did not know how to run a business. The bank, one of the Davenport banks, made him hire someone like me to run the company for him. And so I came up here in high expectations and went to work for him. And as I went along, he kept taking more and more business away from me to do inside. And after 6 months, I thought, well, so I went in and talked to him. I said, John, if you let me run your company, I guarantee you I will make you a millionaire in 6 months. He listened to that, and then he went on about his business. And he was consulted worldwide. He did some things. One of the most unique things he did was he took a B-47 bomber jet engine and turned it vertically and dried blood in a slaughterhouse in Denver, Colorado. That is a trick. Whoa. This is an indication of his tremendous intellectual abilities.
Mm-hmm. So why isn't that enough? I mean,
well, he wanted to run everything from his office, and even when he's traveling, he would call back to people. He had a headset that he used when he was in the office talking to people worldwide. The Russians loved him, the Japanese loved him, but he fired me 2 weeks before Christmas in 1973.
Hi, Santa.
And yeah. So I went home and talked to my wife, but before that, I found out a couple of years later, John died in a small apartment that he was 30 days from being evicted. He just did not know how to handle money. He wanted to do everything himself, but there's some things he's very gifted at, extremely gifted, other things not so. So I came home and told my wife. He said, George, you've always wanted to run your own business. Why don't you just do it and get it out of your system? And 43 years later, I did.
What did you do? What was your business?
Well, we made small parts for companies like Caterpillar, John Deere, Han Industries. And I started with, when he had fired me, he gave me 2 weeks separation pay, and I started. I had a drawing board in the basement of our house and an old blacksmith vise, and that was it. And so I started doing what they call detailing work for several companies, where I would make their prints and make them more printable, mm-hmm. and do that work. But I always liked to do, wanted to get into some manufacturing. And then I eventually did. I got some small work. You have to be a little naive. I was working out of our house, and then one day I saw Caterpillar bought a plant where the Shepherd Company is in Riverdale now. And I was busy doing small pieces of work, and I went down and talked to him. Being naive, I went and met the plant manager, and Wes said, "How are you?" He says, "You know, would you want to rent some space to a small manufacturer?" And he didn't laugh at me, but he thought, "Well, maybe I can help this guy." And he was the plant manager. But then a week later, or so, he took me to Peoria or Morton, Illinois, where he was, assistant plant manager. This is while he was living in a motel in Geneseo, building a house and going through union negotiations. But he took the time, Wes McGarvey, and Wes Bracken, rather, and took me down there and introduced me and said, "Give this guy a chance to see if he can do anything." And that was how I started.
Before we run out of time, we would like to hear a little bit from your book. Something you think might be of interest.
Yes, well, it's family instances of pain for their own lunch, pain their own way. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that my priorities, this is what I'm reading. I mentioned earlier that my priorities were Christ, family, company, and others. Rather than ever lose my family, I would easily have chosen to lose my company. I'm reminded of an experience from the time when I was employed by the Pillsbury Company in Springfield, Illinois. I was on a business trip that several of us took to visit a small company in Wisconsin. The owner of the small company was using an idea unique to the food industry to improve his processing and make a better food product. in the course of our conversations, he told me that his work took so much time that he had to make a decision between staying married or keeping his work. He chose the company. I was disturbed by his comments and felt sorry for this man who chose business over family. I feel fortunate that our three children worked in the business for various periods of time as their contributions to helping the company grow. My wife, Sue, worked for me part-time as the bookkeeper for over 8 years before she retired at her request. There is no way I can repay this wonderful person for the sacrifice she made for me, except by trying to show my deep love for her. Tom, our oldest child, started working during the summers when he was 12 years old. He swept floors, painted the building walls, and did other non-production miscellaneous jobs necessary to the operation. When he was in high school, he began operating machines, starting with a small Logan engine lathe. This hands-on work continued while he was in a co-op his first 2 years as an engineering student at the University of Iowa. This experience enabled him to work as a co-op student in his last 2 years in college for a local Alcoa plant. He excelled in sports and academics in high school at Pleasant Valley, earning Academic Sports Athlete of the Year his senior year. But I'm proudest of his work experience when in junior high school he missed only one day due to illness during the 2 years he delivered newspapers by himself. He got up at 5:30 every morning to do so. Susan, now Sue Sampson, our next oldest child, started working at the company when she was 10, emptying waste containers and doing other office jobs. She continued to work part-time at Seabrook in the summer while going to college after she was married. One of our buyers remembers seeing Susan smartly and correctly answering the phone when the person came for her job interview in 1980, even though Susan was only 15 years old. Some special moments for me were when she was chosen as homecoming queen in high school and when she set a school record that stands in the 880-yard run. But I was proudest of her when I saw her happily serving food in hairnet and uniform in the dorm cafeteria at the University of Iowa her freshman year as a way to help pay for her education. Our youngest, Anne, she is now Anne Atkinson, followed the pattern of her siblings by working during her junior high years doing office cleaning duties. Her high school and college summers were spent helping out in the office doing filing, answering the phone, and other similar duties, as well as working at other local businesses. Even though she was a high school All-American sprinter, I was proudest of her when she positively asserted her position without being intimidated on an issue in a classroom at the University of Kentucky when one of her professors discriminated against her. We try to have a positive home environment for the children to grow up in, and we encourage them to form friendships with classmates who had the same kind of positive outlook on life. Through all of their experiences at the company, our children learn the value and rewards that productive work brings. Through these family experiences, I've enjoyed seeing the self-esteem and self-confidence our kids develop that comes from them earning their own way in the world.
You've just created about 400 envious parents.
That's true.
Well, I'm just very thankful for what happened.
Well, you know, but that, for many people, is the key. If you start your own business, it helps if you've got a family to help you.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Because if everybody pitches in for a common purpose, that does shares the load a little bit.
Yes, well, when Sue started, she didn't know how to run an accounting book. So she went to our accountant who did our taxes and says, well, Sue, on the left side of the page are credits and on the right side are debits. And you work with that through the checkbook. And she did a marvelous job. She balances to the penny. She's very good at that.
I find women are excellent when you in detail work, better than men in many cases. But of course, that's the personal side of it, but then your book also gives insights into how to run a business.
Oh, yes, yes.
How to get it started.
Well, one of the things are the five factors that determine a business is cash, time, space, skills, and equipment. Mm-hmm. For instance, you could have replicated my manufacturing business with the lasers and the press brakes, the shears and welding machines and lathes anywhere in the world. But you couldn't replicate the employees. And I always maintained many years that my most valuable asset walked out the door at the end of the shift every day.
You know, that's true. And I know when I have managed anything, I think it's the people who actually do the work. Anybody, as I've said many times, anybody can have a good idea, but it takes people to make an idea real.
Oh, yes, for sure.
And if you don't value employees, you probably shouldn't be in business.
Exactly. And treat them as who they really are. And they're such an invaluable asset to you and helping you. I'm going back to Lincoln Electric Company in Cleveland, Ohio. At the time I went to see them, there were 2,500 employees on Euclid Avenue in Cleveland. Everybody felt they had a say in what went on, even this larger company was that was. And they would have a meeting with the director, chairman of the board, once a month. I believe it was once a month, from 60 different departments. And people would elect the person to come and be there. And they could say anything they wanted to for the benefit of the company.
You know, that is so simple, obvious, and reasonable. You wonder why companies don't do that. Because I've found that the hardest thing in a major corporation is getting information from the floor up to the executive suite. If by the time it filters through many people, it can be 180 degrees from what it should be.
Yes.
So you need that direct contact.
I learned this from where my dad worked. He was a tool and die maker at Erickson Engineering Company in Moline. And he said that Eric Erickson would walk through the shop every day and say hello to every single person. Mm-hmm. And so they felt to be a part of it. I did this every day. I would go and sit, talk to people and say, hello, how are you today? And let them know that I valued them.
Well, George Seberg, you've had a very interesting career. And Where Angels Fear to Tread, how can we get hold of that book?
Well, there are several at the library. I think Moline, I know Bettendorf has one, but also it's available on Amazon.com. And it's I've spoken at several schools. One is I was invited to speak at the University of Iowa one year for 30 top graduates in engineering and business about the book. And I also spoke at Hillsdale College, among others, in Hillsdale, Michigan, which is the only institution of higher learning in the United States that receives no government money.
Hmm. Well, and you've spoken to us and our listeners, and we really appreciate it, George.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay. And from George Seberg, we go to another dedicated man, Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. It was interesting listening to George because when I ran for the Senate, I had to leave my job. No means of support, so
right.
I tried to start my own little advertising company. Barely survived one year.
It has got to be a brutal thing to try to do. I've been trying for years to get people to write the history of the Bettendorf Car Company, which to me is more important even than the Rock Island Lines as far as railroad history. In 1903, the Bettendorf Car Company started with two little guys and an idea of a single-piece truck that holds the wheels that really revolutionized the whole railroad industry in the United States. They started with a few employees making this truck, and within 15 years, they had 10,000 employees, a mile-long factory in which raw materials, including ores, went in one end of the factory, and every hour a completed railroad car went out the other end of the factory. Just unbelievable. And they devised new ways of doing it. And then suddenly in 3 years, 1933, partly because of the result of the Depression, they were completely bankrupt. How can a company that successful all of a sudden go inside out? So I think George is right. Business is a mean business.
You know, large corporations run on a very careful track. I was talking to a fellow at Deere one time when times were tough. I said, well, I suppose you can reduce the price of your products. He says, no, you can't.
Right.
He says, every step of the way, the price is kind of factored in, and you really have to get that price. So the larger you get, the less flexibility you have. Small business can be somewhat agile, but always there's the temptation to grow, to get bigger.
Yeah, it's the idea of starting a business to me is frightening.
That's right. You want to grow, and no one is ever satisfied with this much. You want a little more and a little more. And it's not always money. It's just growing the business, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Those businesses that find the right niche and are content to serve that niche well have, I think, a much better chance of lasting. But who knows?
They don't all last.
Yeah,
that's true. Very few of them last.
That's true. My father ran through a couple of restaurants in his lifetime.
Right.
Finally wound up working as a dining car steward,
right.
Which was a much more stable
right.
occupation, I'll tell you. But his saying was, people always have to eat. So a restaurant business should work if you know how to purchase, prepare, price, and serve. I thought, those are four really important things.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you learn it the hard way usually,
right? Oh, you
right?
do. You really do. But in the book bag today, I've got a magazine. It's Laugham's Quarterly. George Laugham was a fellow who, I think it's George, started out as an essayist. And I used to read his stuff, Lewis Laugham.
That's Lewis it. Laugham. Editor of Harper's, wasn't he, or Atlantic?
Well, one of those two.
Yes.
I confuse them all the time.
I do, too.
But one of them I would always open and read the Laugham essay. Brilliant stuff, wonderfully written. And when he retired or quit or whatever, I thought, you know, we've lost a wonderful writer. And then all of a sudden he comes back with his Quarterly. And every four times a year, he puts out this 200-page magazine, which is like a soft cover book, big size almost of a regular page, just short, just a little smaller. He picks one topic, and he combs through all of history for interesting articles by people from the ancient world to the modern, brief essays on a single topic. And this latest one is fear.
You gave me a subscription to that last year, and the first one I got, I got this in the mail, and I said, what is all this about, though? 200 pages on the topic, I think, was discovery. Who wants to sit down and read page after page on one? Well, you don't read very far before you find it's very difficult to put down.
Oh, yeah.
It ranges all over the place.
That's true. So that's something you ought to examine. Laugham's Quarterly, as you get it by mail, by subscription.
Or at Barnes & Noble's, I think.
Yeah, they might have a copy there. And you'll find us here next week, and we hope you'll return for the next edition of Scribble.